We are back with Kevin Phillips. Bill Russell took us out in the last segment talking about an unholy troika of Bill.
Religion, politics, and war.
Well, those were the mainstays of the 16th and 17th century. Those were the three things that made the wheels of international relations go around, and for that matter, the internal conflicts, too. And that's what I found dominant in those early years, and even by the time you got into the 19th and 20th centuries, you had economics, you had culture, but you still just faced an enormous impact out of religion and war. And I think we're facing right now in the Middle East, in the Caucasus, in Southeast Asia, in the Balkans, in many places, all of a sudden, front and center, religion, politics, and war. And nobody's talking about the Stamp Act or customs duties or school integration. They're talking about religion, politics, and war, from the Balkans to the South China Sea.
I was very struck by how regularly English and Americans, who, as you say, are cousins, directly, I mean, biologically cousins, how often we were ready, willing, and able to resolve our conflicts by going to war.
Well, yes and no. Yes, in the sense that, sure, and you can take besides the three, you can have lesser conflicts like the War of the Roses and the various foreign wars that Britain got in and the United States got in. But then there were, at these important intervals, the willingness to fight civil wars, but not so frequently that they were wasted. They were only used to settle big things, and that's part of the continuity, too. In contrast to the Nicaraguas and the Spains and all the countries that we sort of assume do these things lightly and have generals that have decorations when they've never been in a serious campaign and everything. When we do it, big stuff. Not often, but very important.
But it's also worth saying this. I mean, going back to England as the initial melting pot or stratifying process, those people were coming out of horrific conditions in Europe that had been triggered by the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation. And they were so glad to be somewhere else that I think it must have taken a little while before the values were transmogrified sufficiently for that first war to trigger, and then the subsequent. But a lot of this has to do with the reaction to the horrors that were going on in Europe.
Well, there's an interesting pattern there, because the British, for all that they were involved in wars within the British Isles, were spared the external wars, from the exception of the Spanish Armada, which never got there, from the 1460s and 70s all the way through the 1640s. They were not invaded from the continent. They did not have a major involvement there. The people who were just shattered by the wars really were the people that came from Germany, where the bitterness had been incredible. And a lot of these people you find in Pennsylvania Dutch country today, and in the Effretas and all the way down to Winston-Salem in North Carolina, you see these old German buildings that look like the 17th century. And all these people wanted to do was get away. They refused to fight. They wouldn't pay taxes to support armies. And they meant it. People,
and there were lots of them.
Yeah. Anglo-Saxons didn't believe they meant it. They meant it. Anglo-Saxons had not been in that 30 years warfare in Germany. But it was pretty severe for the Irish, who learned the hard way from the English. And they, too, were shattered culturally by war.
Both the German and the Irish experience, as you describe it, it was worth plowing through 600-plus pages just to remember how central those two ethnic communities' experiences were in America. That is kind of outside the 4th of July version that most of us got in second grade.
Well, the 4th of July version has a lot of holes. There's no doubt about it. Any country,
so does second grade.
Any country's 4th of July version has a lot of holes. Yeah. That's one of the things you really realize. But the Irish, well, an easy way to start this is to say that the last census showed that there were 38 million Americans who cite Irish as their principal ancestry. In the British Isles, there are only about 6 or 7 million. Mm. And if you throw in Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, you clearly get it up to 43, 44 million. So the Irish are no longer in the British Isles. The Scots are predominantly out of the British Isles. The Welsh, a little less. It's the English who basically won in the British Isles, chased everybody else out. So the flavor of the United States, and it's true of Australia and Canada as well, is much more Irish, Scottish, and then the German impact in the United States is enormous. You've got 53 million Americans who give German as their principal ancestry. And the British made sure, and they didn't know what they were doing, but most of the Germans that left Europe settled in British colonies or English-speaking countries. So when the great fights came in the 20th century, they spoke English, they wore khaki uniforms, and they landed in Southampton and Plymouth.
You make quite a point that the Revolutionary War, that all of this stuff is unintentional, not preconceived. Jared Diamond said to us that, yes, in fact, humans thought up agriculture, but it was all unconscious. And I had the sense, reading about these great conflicts, that these things had happened and that these things happened. Looking back, it's easy to say, well, it was really important for America to do what America did and then Britain to do what Britain did so that we could win the Second War. But we didn't know what we were doing, did we?
No, but people knew they were heading for trouble by a certain point. You can look back at all three wars, and especially during the decade. The decade becomes important. The 10 years before the English Civil War, the 10 years before the American Revolution, the 10 years before the Civil War, you could see the animosity, the cleavages, the tension all building up. So as that took place, then I think you were looking at something that was closing in on inevitability. Something was going to trigger it because the animosities were there. And the sense of conspiracy was there. These people are trying to get us. And in that sense, I never thought when it came it was accidental.
Mm-hmm. There's a dynamism in this. I mean, that, you know, consciously or unconsciously, you know, we seem to be going someplace. Thinking of religion and politics, there's an easy jump from religion, the values incumbent in a religious perspective, that become manifest in the public arena by way of politics. And if the conflicts within a community get too great, then you end up with wars. And we have evolved a set of values over the course of those three wars that are substantially different, radically different, I think. And essentially, that we've moved from a medieval society to a 21st century society with values that are substantially different, punctuated by those three wars, haven't we?
The interesting question to me is whether there's a new one that has been created by the lack of war and a different evolution of the culture, because it's pretty clear that religion was part of the conflict that precipitated each of these wars.
That they were fighting over the religious issues themselves?
Well, in one way
themselves.
Or another, they were conditioned by religious splits, or the religious climates created moral issues. It came in different flavors. But at this point, we have a lot of the same tensions even within the United States, forget in the Balkans or in the Caucasus or the Middle East. And a lot of animosity. People would sort of like to be fighting each other some of the time, and you can't do it. Middle-class societies won't do that. And as a result, I think it puts a tension and an ineffectiveness into politics that then isn't very easily resolved, and you can't improve your politics. There is something to be said historically for wars. They clear the air. They set something in motion again that people have decided is important, and then they go with those lines of alignment.
They clear the air, but you also say that they don't finish the job, that the air continues to have some murk that collects again.
Yes, each of these wars seeded another one. But on the other hand, if you look at the time frame between them, it was a pretty goodly amount of time. 130 years from the English Civil War to the American Revolution, then essentially 90 down to the Civil War. And the alignments that were created were pretty workable for a pretty long time. And right at this point, you have people talking in the United States about culture wars. And we have been talking about them since the 1960s. And you've had two presidents impeached, a lot of animosity. And there's something that's in human nature that needs to be drained off periodically. And we haven't figured the new drainage system. Now, maybe other parts of the world are still working on the old drainage system, and that's going to do the job.
This is politics continued by other means.
It is.
And war continued by other means in politics. And what I'm hearing you say is that, you know, we don't have the venting system, the ventilation system that war is. It's just simply not acceptable, which is fine. But we haven't found the way to deal with those growing discontinuities.
Well, I have a further theory that bothers me quite a bit. It's that looking back at civil wars within important countries, you see that it was after those civil wars the country was typically at its peak, and that as the country then sort of stratified and entrenched and lost its vitality and had interest groups and all of these things, as well as a sense that we can't fight anymore, usually that was related with a maturation process, which then set them up over a century or two for other people who hadn't made that transformation and were still hungry, still the product of civil wars, and still fighting.
We're going to come back and continue this conversation with Kevin Phillips in just a moment. We hope you'll be with us when the Paula Gordon Show returns.